Okay, well, it's a great pleasure to be here to celebrate Bill's birthday and impending retirement. I chose the topic of my talk today because some 25 years ago, Bill pointed out that an interaction between steady states and a Hopf bifurcation can lead to quasi-periodic motion. And this paper, I think, has had a lot of influence, particularly on those of us who are interested in applications of dynamical systems to experiments. So I want to discuss one such application that I've been involved in recently, which I think is quite interesting from this point of view. So the work I want to talk about is was done by Oriol Batista, who is a postdoc of mine in Leeds, and Marta Net and Isabel Mercader in Barcelona. So this talk will contain very little mathematics, actually, but I really want to tell you something about the physical system, the simulations that we have, and then how the work that Bill has done is helpful in trying to understand what's observed. So let me start with experiments. So these are experiments that were published almost 10 years ago by Paul Kolodna, and they are experiments on a mixture of two fluids, in this case water and ethanol, contained in a three-dimensional box. It's a closed box, and it's heated from below. And under appropriate conditions, when a certain parameter called S here, called separation ratio, is negative, the initial onset of instability is an oscillatory instability. And this container is relatively extended. It's 16 times as wide as it's high. And so the instability tends to evolve into waves, nonlinear waves, that then interact with the boundaries, right? And this talk is really about the interaction of nonlinear waves with walls, with boundaries, which, by the way, is a very interesting topic. It's a topic in wave theory, but it's not hyperbolic waves because these are driven dissipative systems. So let me tell you a little bit about what was observed. So what Kolodna does, he visualizes his flow patterns by shining light through the layer using a so-called shadow graph procedure, and then he measures the light intensity at a particular point in the cell, and that's taken to be as indicative of what goes on in the whole container. And so this is the typical kind of time series that that you find in the experiment. This is over many hours. And the thing that I want to emphasize is that these time series are observed very close to the threshold of the primary instability, 0.06% above thresholds. It's almost as close as you can get to the initial instability in an experiment as is possible. So these are very accurate experiments, and the remarkable thing is that the first state that he sees in this experiment is this relatively complicated state where you have a very fast frequency, that's the oscillatory, basically the Hopf frequency, and superposed on this you can see additional frequencies. And then as you increase this parameter epsilon, which is the fractional distance above threshold, the pattern or the time series changes quite dramatically, but in this picture still within a fraction of a percent of the initial instability. And so one of the things I'd like to try to understand are basically what are these patterns, first of all, how do they come into being, and what's responsible for the transition as you vary the forcing of the system, which in this case is the temperature difference imposed across the system. Okay, so there are going to be two different types of states that I'll focus on. There's going to be these states, which I will call repeated transients. This is the terminology from Kolodna's paper. And basically, the idea here is that there is some kind of event that kills the convection, the motion in the system off, and it has to restart again from essentially zero. So it's a kind of regrowth from very small amplitude, and then it evolves to a finite state, but then the finite state is unstable and the whole thing collapses and you kind of do it again, right? So he's called this a repeated transient. But it's a fully nonlinear state of the system. It's nothing to do with a linear transient. And then there are these other states, which I will call blinking states because they correspond to a certain type of oscillation in the cell. There's an additional set of data from the same paper, which is summarized in this plot. So what's drawn here, again, are sample time series plotted horizontally, but now they are plotted for different values of the aspect ratio of the system. So the aspect ratio is just the dimensionless width of the, or the length of the container. And what's plotted here is the length of the container minus an integer. So for example, when n is 17, this corresponds, this time series corresponds to a container of length 17. This time series would correspond to a container of length 17 and a quarter, 17 and a half, and so on. So you can see that the aspect ratio is very significant. It really changes the dynamics of what goes on. But what is interesting is that if I, instead of choosing 17, I choose 16, then the time series is more or less insensitive to changing the aspect ratio by something of order 1, right? But the fractional changes are very important. These are all measured at the same point. It's somewhere not in the middle of the container. It's a generic point. And of course, the way he does this, he has a cell and he can actually pull out the side to change the aspect ratio in a continuous way. Excuse me? Oh yeah, no, they're not all periodic, certainly. I'm not. Yeah, well, you'll see lots of pictures like this in what I'm going to show you. And I mean, some of these states are periodic, some are non-periodic. And one of the things that's interesting to understand is what is responsible for the presence of these states, and in particular whether they are periodic or not. So I'll try to address that. So just briefly, why does the system behave this way? Well, physically, the argument is quite straightforward. If you have a mixture which has this negative separation ratio and you impose a temperature gradient across the system, heating it from below, the heavier component of the mixture migrates towards the bottom and creates a stabilizing contribution to the density, which then competes with the destabilizing thermal buoyancy. And that's a sensitive system, and under appropriate conditions, namely when the stabilizing concentration gradient that's produced in response to the thermal forcing is strong enough, this system will in fact oscillate at onset. Okay, so this is a nice situation because you're creating the competition between the destabilizing thermal buoyancy and the stabilizing concentration contribution through the same effect, namely by heating the system. Excuse me? It's a diffusive process. It's a cross-diffusion process. It's the Soray effect, that's right. I wasn't expecting physics questions, but great. So we solve the equations for this system just in two dimensions, and it's interesting, in fact, that the two-dimensional calculations I'll present do pretty well in explaining these observations. And we solve them with realistic boundary conditions. Namely, we impose no slip boundary conditions everywhere. There's no mass flux out of the box. The boundaries are impenetrable. We have no sideways heat flux in this direction. And as I said, we impose a temperature difference delta T across the system, and that then produces this concentration difference delta C. So I won't write down the equations, but they're basically just the Navier-Stokes equation together with an equation for the advection and diffusion of temperature and advection and diffusion of concentration. Very standard equations, incompressible. The important thing is that there are some parameters, and I've just mentioned these here for reference. There is a number of in fluid mechanics we call the Rayleigh number. It's just a dimensionless measure of the forcing of the system. It's proportional to this temperature difference delta T. There is a Prandtl number that we've already heard about before from Steve Morris. It's a ratio of kinematic viscosity to thermal diffusivity. That's something like 0.6 or 7 for the water ethanol mixture. There is this separation ratio, which is proportional to the Soray coefficient that Walter mentioned. There is a Lewis number, which is an important parameter. It's the ratio of the diffusion coefficient of the concentration to the thermal diffusivity. And most importantly, as we saw already, there is this dimensionless aspect ratio of the system called gamma. So the first thing I want to do is tell you what happens if you take the fluid equations and you linearize them about the no-motion state in which heat and concentration are transported by diffusion. And you indeed find an oscillatory instability, and this is the kind of eigenfunction that that you observe. So this is for a particular set of parameters. This is the stream function, the temperature, the concentration. And there are two classes of modes. That's the first thing to point out. There are modes which are called even and odd. They're even and odd with respect to a reflection in the middle. And you should think of this really as each of these slices corresponds to a fixed time. And so this is a space-time diagram, and you can see how the pattern or the eigenfunction evolves in time over one period, namely 2 pi over omega c, where omega c is the hop frequency. So these are strictly periodic eigenfunctions, but the interesting thing is that for a while the pattern is essentially stationary, and then the middle row splits, and at the same time rows are disappearing at the two boundaries. So this is the typical eigenfunction that you see, and for this particular set of parameter values and this aspect ratio, the state that has a lower Rayleigh number is the even mode. So one of the things we want to know, of course, is what happens to these states as you go into the nonlinear regime. And so we perform fully nonlinear simulations of the fluid equations for these nominal experimental parameter values. And we're going to look for values of this epsilon, the distance above threshold, within a few percent or less of the initial instability. And we want to try to understand, as I said, these blinking states, the repeated states, and these chevron states, which resemble the eigenfunctions that I've just shown you. So here is a summary of some of our calculations. So the top plot here shows the aspect ratio between 16 and 17, the Rayleigh number plotted vertically. The threshold for the linear instability is over here. As you see, it's the initial instability is to these even states that I showed you. If you choose an aspect ratio over here, the initial instability would be to one of these odd states, odd parity states. And these black dots show the simulations which are represented in the plot below. So here are the time series at the various dots. And this set of numbers here indicates how far above threshold you are. So this would be 2.6 times 10 to the minus 4 above threshold. So what you see here is that for a long time you have this nonlinear periodic state that looks like the eigenfunction that I just showed you. But if you are careful about doing your numerics, then after a long time, this is time in vertical diffusion times, this state becomes unstable and collapses to a small value, and then it starts to regrow again. So that looks very much like what you saw in the experiment. If you choose a different aspect ratio over here, you see that you get a very different time series that looks like it has two frequencies. There is the fast frequency, and then there is this modulation on top of that. So that's like the blinking state that I introduced in the experiments.
Let's go back to an earlier question, but is this again looking at point-wise values?
Okay, so what we do here is we plot, well, we don't plot the light intensity at a point, but we look at the vertical velocity at a point.
Well, okay, so when it collapses, and when this black line becomes zero, does that mean the whole pattern has disappeared?
No, at that point it's disappeared. And in fact, what you will see is that the pattern moves, of course, in space, and under appropriate conditions, you may have states which are localized, and they may traverse the point at which you're actually performing your measurement. I'll show you some space-time plots to actually see.
The shifting of a half a wavelength or whatever in space is very relevant to the hyperplanic particle behavior. That's
what they do. Well, this is due to a different mechanism in this case. So let me first show you one of these nonlinear states that resembles the eigenfunction. So you see this is a fully nonlinear state at some particular value of epsilon. In fact, epsilon here is negative, so this in fact is a subcritical state, but it's stable. And you see this state has symmetry about the midplane, and you get this periodic splitting of the central row. So the whole pattern traverses as a function of time, produces kind of counter-propagating waves that propagate outwards from the center. So this is these are the states that I will refer to as chevrons. So So what I want to show you here is for gamma is 16.25, a set of time series, just increasing epsilon. This dashed line shows the linear stability threshold, which we've where the eigenfunctions were computed, of course. And what you see here is that if you go back down, you see this state, which has this kind of second frequency superposed on it. If you go down a little bit more in epsilon, you get just a pure chevron with this fast frequency, which is almost the hop frequency. And then if you go down too far, of course, it decays away. Right? So that suggests a saddle node bifurcation here. There's some kind of bifurcation here. It goes from here to here. And then as you increase epsilon, you get more complicated behavior. So this is to be contrasted with what happens at a slightly different value of gamma. So this is gamma 16, and you get very different behavior. So here again is the linear stability threshold. If you go down in epsilon, you see the state that is like the repeated transient state. You start from a small amplitude, you grow slowly, then you have go through this collapse, then you grow again. And eventually, if you go down in epsilon too far, everything decays away. Now, this time series is quite interesting because it looks like there are three frequencies in this state. And yet, it's essentially the first state that you see. There's the fast frequency, which is this solid line. That's the black area. And then there is this modulation frequency. But then there are these additional very long period events, which seem to be repeating with a third and very low frequency. Now, if you go up in this direction, then these states eventually transform into a state like this, which, again, is what I call the blinking state. So let me show you one of these blinking states, gamma equals 16. So what's shown here is the velocity at some point in the vertical velocity at some point at the right and vertical velocity at the mirror image to the left. And you see that these are completely out of phase. And so this tells you that what's happening is that the wave in one half of the box is growing at the expense of the one in the opposite half, and they're basically doing something like this, right? So that's a instability of the of this chevron or symmetric state that I already showed you. The eigenvalues are simple in this case because of there's no translation variance. It's a box. You can of course arrange to look near codimension 2 points where the neutral stability curves cross, but I'm not actually doing that. Just to convince you that if I go from 16 gamma equals 16 to gamma equals 17, I get essentially the same picture. You see again here this repeated transient, and then the blinking states up here. So that's this more or less period one symmetry of the problem that was revealed by the experiment. So how might one try to understand this? Well, if you look at a Hopf bifurcation in an unbounded system with O2 symmetry, with perfect boundary conditions, then you get this, you have multiple eigenvalues, and you get these well-known diagrams. So in this picture, for example, the initial instability is to stable standing waves and to stable traveling waves and to unstable standing waves. And then if you imagine bringing boundaries in from infinity, breaking the translation variance, you're going to unfold this multiple instability. And this gives you a very natural mechanism for generating these blinking states. So here is a picture of what happens. If you look over here, then the typical way the picture splits up is that the standing waves split up and the traveling waves have to be a secondary instability because they don't fit into a container with broken translation invariance. So you get something like this, but if you, depending on the domain length in units of the wavelength of the pattern, you may also get a diagram like this, or one like this, where there is a secondary Hopf bifurcation produced on the branch of standing waves. And if you look at what that state looks like, well, you have a large amplitude of a left traveling wave in the left, and then half a period later you have a large amplitude of a right traveling wave in the right half of the box. So this is exactly this kind of sloshing that you saw in the numerical simulations. So that's very easy to understand. The frequencies match, yeah, if you make estimates of how they should depend on parameters. But the repeated transients are a problem, and this is where Bill rides in to help us out. And so what you can do is you can do averaging on this problem, because the frequency, the hop frequency, is a fast frequency, as we saw in all of these diagrams. So I'm going to average out the initial hop frequency and then write down an equation for a real variable, which I call z, which is the amplitude of this symmetric state, the chevron state. Now, we saw that it was subcritical, so I'm going to put a positive coefficient a here and then stabilize it by adding a fifth order term. Now, to do that rigorously, I have to assume that a is small and look in some particular region of parameter space, but let me just call it a model and avoid details like that. So that's going to give me the description of the chevrons, and then this parameter, or this variable y, measures the effect of the odd parity chevron, the competing parity perturbations. So y is going to denote oscillations about the chevron state that I have. And now this y, of course, is going to decay when y is small, but then the coupling to nonlinear terms just from symmetry has to take this form. And there are, of course, two possibilities. One is that C is negative or C is positive. And, of course, the interesting case for our purpose is that C is positive.
So Y is the radial part of the hop?
No. So what you want to think of is...
periodic orbit, but Y is just the amplitude.
Y is just the amplitude here. And I'll make it into a periodic orbit in just a moment. Right? So the idea is that Z is the amplitude of the chevron, Y is a perturbation out of the invariant subspace in which the chevron lives, okay? And that means that states of the form Z0, 0 are the chevron states. States of the form Z0, Y0 are going to correspond to the blinking states. The second frequency has been removed here. And states which are periodic orbits in Y and Z, well, they're going to have three frequencies. So how does this work? Right. So I take these equations and look at some bifurcation diagrams in the parameter plane. So the parameters here are mu and this and nu. So when mu is zero, the initial instability occurs. So that occurs along this line called H1. Then there's a saddle node bifurcation because that coefficient A is positive, so that occurs along this line. Then there is a line here of hop bifurcations, but really in the model this just produces states in which Y is non-zero, so that's the onset of blinking states. So that lies those lie in here, and then of course you have an interaction between this hop bifurcation and the saddle node. And that produces a line of what in Bill's original paper were tori, but here they're actually going to correspond to three frequency states, and they lie below this line. And then, of course, those three frequency states disappear in a global bifurcation along this curve gamma. So the local analysis would just give you this picture. Here, of course, we can follow this line gamma all the way to here. And the interesting thing for our purposes is that over here, you see that this curve of gamma is essentially, it's exponentially close to this curve mu equals zero. So if you go along here, you see that the global bifurcation essentially coincides with the onset of the initial instability. And in the experiments, unlike in the numerical simulations, they see almost no hysteresis between the initial instability and the appearance of these repeated transients. So I'll try to indicate that in these pictures. So here is the bifurcation diagram, subcritical chevrons, stable chevrons here. Then here is the bifurcation to blinking, and these are stable blinking states. Over here, what I've done is I've taken this point and I've just pushed it through the saddle node bifurcation. I do that by varying the size of the container, and I get a picture like this. I have unstable blinking states here, so this is a half bifurcation, but I have another half bifurcation that produces at the third frequency here. Produces these states, which are the repeated transient states, and then they disappear in a Hopf bifurcation, which is very close to mu equals zero. And what you can see, and if you look at the time series along this periodic branch of solutions, that you have here a state in which Z grows while Y is still zero. So that means you have a pure parity growing state. And then when you reach the steady state and it collapses, you're exciting Y, right? So that means that you're exciting the blinking mode. It's the blinking mode that destroys the steady chevrons and brings you back down to the small amplitude state. So here is something that you would see for a slightly smaller value of this parameter nu, and you really see that the this global bifurcation gets hung up on the on mu equals zero, the initial instability, and it gives rise to these states which collapse down to essentially zero amplitude, and then they regrow very slowly. That's the growing chevron before it collapses again.
So what kind of bifurcation?
Global bifurcation.
Yeah, but what?
It's a heteroclinic orbit. Yeah. So how does this work, kind of in comparison with the simulations? Well, it works very nicely because this picture really corresponds to this very well. You see here a saddle node bifurcation between here and here. So that's this thing, stable chevrons. That's this state here. Then when you cross this point, you have the onset of the blinking, and then as you march along here, various other things occur. Which are not part of this particular reduction. If you look at, say, gamma equals 17, and you have these repeated transients, you see that the state decays, and here the first state that you see is this three-frequency state, the fast frequency, then here is the second frequency, and then there is a third frequency which measures the repetition of these events, and that's the very slow frequency because it's produced through that bifurcation over there. And then, of course, at larger amplitude, these kind of states disappear, and you just have pure blinking, and these are the states up there. Now, you can look at some diagnostics of what actually goes on. And so what I've shown here is the vertical velocity at the right point and the mirror image at the left half of the box. If you look in this region, you see that the evolution is essentially in this plane. So that means your reflection symmetric, so that's the chevron state. When you reach this state, the evolution in this direction, so you're exciting the variable y. And of course, in between, you're doing both. So this works perfectly. If you want to compare the data just a little more carefully, then you might want to put in the frequency, which I factored out, and that's the blinking frequency. So instead of having the variable y, I now have a complex variable v. And then, of course, v is this quantity I called y and a phase. So this theta dot is this blinking frequency. And then you might want to construct a proxy of the shadow graph signal, which would be the z of t plus real part of v, which is y of t times cosine of theta t. And then I've just put in here the chevron frequency omega 1. So if you plot what this thing looks like for comparison with what you get in the experiments, well, these repeated transients up here now look like this, and they have the three frequencies built in, right? So you have this growing chevron, and then it reaches this unstable steady state and then collapses in this oscillatory fashion. And it's interesting to compare this kind of signature with what Kolodner observed in his experiments. And so here are some data from his paper. And, of course, the comparison I'm trying to make is that this thing looks almost identical to this proxy time series that I constructed by putting in these two additional frequencies, including this overshoot and this oscillatory collapse and so on. The other thing that's interesting from his experiments is that he looks at the modulation of the basic chevron period. Depending on the aspect ratio, the period comes in with some finite value, and it just increases as you increase delta t. But for other aspect ratios, he finds that if he decreases epsilon, then the period actually goes up, and it's clear that this very rapid increase in the period is because he has this very low third frequency, which he didn't know about. He was just looking for a single period modulation of the basic pattern. So all of this is completely consistent with with the model. So why does the model work? The model works because, in fact, this system, even though it has length 16, is in fact relatively small. In particular, what I mean by a small domain is that gamma is actually less than epsilon to the minus a half. This is the Ginzburg-Landau scaling, so-called. Epsilon was 10 to the minus 4. 16 is less than 100. So this is, in fact, still a small domain, and so this finite dimensional analysis can be expected to work. In the more recent work, what we've done is we've taken the same system, but now increased epsilon. That's really like making the domain larger and larger, right? And so the dynamics then becomes more different because more and more modes are excited. And I just show you one picture of what you find is that the time series evolves to this. And now you see states which are fully localized in space. You have essentially nothing in a domain for some time and a state in one half of the box. And then various other interesting things happen to get a transition from this state to this state. This obviously is in some sense periodic and symmetric, but the details of these transitions are fully high dimensional behavior and cannot be explained by this low dimensional approach. So let me put up my conclusions. So I've shown you that in these extended domains, the dynamics behaves sensitively. Depends sensitively on both the aspect ratio and epsilon. We have this periodic dependence on gamma with period roughly 1. Essentially, they correspond to adding a role so that you change the symmetry from even to odd. We saw that the chevron states bifurcate subcritically and that they can acquire stability. And then beyond that, they can lose stability to these blinking states. And in other regimes, we had these interesting repeated transients, which are three frequency states, and that come in the experiment essentially without any hysteresis. And it's interesting from a fluid mechanical problem to see these complicated states right at onset of an instability. So thank you.